the women that we've been discovering over here, the Irish are only just beginning to discover their women. I spoke at a UK Association of Women Judges conference back in November, thank you. And there was two Irish women judges there who were absolutely thrilled to have discovered this woman. You can see her dates, 1893 to 1979. And the only reason I discovered her was because I started writing a book on some of the contemporary women firsts, and I thought I'd better put them in a bit of context. And I looked at the list of those firsts, and I suddenly noticed two Irish women, both called in 1921. And because I have the good fortune to be married to an Irishman, I know my Irish history. And I thought, hang on a minute, that's pre-Anglo-Irish Treaty. November 1921 is a long time before the treaty was signed, let alone implemented. So I went over to Ireland in pursuit of these two women, found that Frances Kyle, who was the first woman to be called, actually didn't practice for a very long time, and gave up. She came from Belfast. So Avril is the first woman to practice in the UK. Some Irish don't like that, of course. They don't like the idea of being part of the UK, as you may have noticed, but be it as it may, she is definitely the first woman in the UK. So as you may have noticed, particularly with current events, the English are not very good at Irish history. Slight understatement. So actually discovering this woman has been enormously exciting for me and for a number of people in Ireland, because her connections to England as an Anglo-Irish woman are quite extraordinary. And the reason that we now know so much about her is because an elderly man found some of her belongings when he bought her house, and he kept them for 40 years. Knew nothing about her, but thought they looked interesting. And I happened to stumble across them. It's a long story, too long for tonight, but I was enormously blessed because she is a woman of many layers, as I have discovered. The picture of her is in the Law Library in Dublin, and it's a picture that she gave them. No officially commissioned portrait of her. She had one commissioned and she gave it to them. She also gave a bequest to Trinity to set up a fellowship in her name. This was not a woman who wished to be forgotten, but forgotten she was. The next slide has her dates. That's her as an older woman in her wig. And she died with no obituary. Her gravestone merely says barrister at law. She's buried with her twin brother in Greystones. And the only person to try and keep her memory alive was one of her younger contemporaries, Dick Cook, who spoke about her at a conference in 2000 in Dublin. And we know a bit about her because he wrote something about her. The next slide actually shows you her achievements. So she's the first woman into King's Inns. She's the second woman called to the bar after Frances Kyle. She's the first in full practice in Ireland and the UK. She's the first secretary of the Dublin University Graduate Women's Association, of which we will hear more later. She also writes the first law report. She's not the first officially appointed woman law reporter, but she's the first woman to write a law report. And that portrait of her in the law library has a sort of rather odd red blob beside her, which is actually a red bag. She's the first and last woman in Ireland to get a red bag. Those of you who are at the bar will know that the red bag is given by the senior counsel to a junior counsel for appearing in front of the Privy Council. And of course, the Irish cases before the Privy Council ended in about 1934. So she's definitely the first and last. And she's the first mother of the bar, because she had such a long career that nobody else could have been mother of the bar. So if you go to the next slide, this is her as a very typically Anglo-Irish debutante. She's presented at Dublin Castle at one of the last such events in Ireland, because of course everything was about to change. And then if you go on to the next slide, she's educated in Bray at a typically Anglo-Irish Protestant school. But the French school in Bray isn't quite what it seems. And Avril isn't quite what she seems. She has a fiercely unionist anti-home rule father. But as we shall discover, she's got some rather interesting connections. This is her headmistress, Caroline Riley, who ran the school later on with a woman called Ruth Young, who almost certainly was a window-smashing suffragette in London. Avril was also at school with the Jeffcott sisters. Who the hell are they? Who cares? The elder of the two sisters she was with was imprisoned in Holloway for window-smashing and was force-fed. And her name is on the Holloway handkerchief. And she's the elder sister of the two who were at school with Avril. Avril must have known about this. Couldn't possibly have escaped it. The quotation at the bottom, "If a female once passed the gate, it would be practically impossible to watch what buildings or what chambers she might enter or how long she might remain there," was from the board of Trinity College refusing entry to women. Avril was one of the first of the women undergraduates at Trinity. They opened their doors in 1904, and they opened their doors fully. Once they'd opened them, they gave women degrees, unlike Cambridge, and indeed Oxford for a while. So if we go on to the next slide. In the very large collection of objects that this man had retained is a large scrapbook. And in the scrapbook is this handwritten programme for a play called How the Vote Was Won, put on by Avril and her friends in Greystones in January 1911, rather a long time before the vote was actually won. And it had first been shown in the Royalty Theatre in London. And if you see the purple arrows, she has put in an instruction to wear badges from the Actresses Franchise League. This is a suffragette play, one of a canon of plays put on by the suffragettes as propaganda, very successful propaganda. The Actresses Franchise League wasn't actually very often mentioned and almost certainly wasn't known in Dublin. So Avril obviously knew something about them. And I'll come back to that point in a moment. If we go on to the next slide, what this archive has taught me is that we very often don't look carefully enough at what women regard as important, the artifacts that women regard as important. any of us would have thrown this piece of paper away. What's it doing in the scrapbook? It's a piece of school exercise book with some names written on it. They're teenagers playing games in 1909 in Greystones. The significance of it is that the two boys at the bottom are on a long list of those killed in Gallipoli and in France. She's kept it because it has enormous meaning. And the death toll in Ireland was huge in very small communities. And half of these men, of course, were at Trinity with her as well. They weren't just playground playmates. If we go on to the next slide, Avril served in the Trinity VAD unit, you know, the voluntary unit that was a nursing unit, from about 1912, so before the war started. She clocked up about 330 hours service with her mother at Greystones War Depot, but she was trying to do more. And eventually, she managed to persuade the authorities to let her become an ambulance driver in France. And, naughty girl, she's kept her military passport. I could kiss her for it, because it has got so much information in it. And I have now found one of the places that she served in France, and there's a photo album waiting for me. If anybody wants to come to Villeneuve-sur-Lot with me, they're more than welcome. So, she is a gift that goes on giving. Now, if we come on to the next slide, she comes back in 1918, and apparently, according to her, is encouraged by her father to apply for the bar. And she does so, as Francis Carl does, knowing that the Sex Disqualification Removal Act is on its way. But the Bar Council in Ireland decide in their wisdom, those benchers, in their wisdom, decide that in the absence of any demand in this country for the admission of women to the bar, the council do not consider it advisable that the bill at present before Parliament should be extended to Ireland. By 1920, they'd given in. Women shall be admitted on precisely the same terms as men, because the Act had been applied to Ireland anyway. And then the benchers in October 1920 voted on whether to give Fáil Cáil and Avril Deverill partial exemptions in Avril's case for her war service. But note the closeness of the vote. They gave these exemptions to the men for their war service. The vote in Avril's case for her war service as an ambulance driver on the front line in France, 17 in favour, 11 against. And if you look at some of the names in the bar archive, some of those names crop up quite often in relation to women. If we go on to the next slide. So with the exemptions, she's then admitted, she's then called to the bar. And she very carefully crosses out the he in the printed form and puts she. If you go on to the next slide, we then see her. This made headline news around the world, but this is definitely my favourite photograph, largely because her twin brother, who was called on the same day, who never practised, had an absolutely brilliant military career and was made an OBE, brigadier, etc. He never practised. So the idea of him as a football at his sister's feet, I think, is rather wonderful. But notice the difference in stance of the two women. Avril is on the right-hand side. She is only 5'5", which actually wasn't particularly unusual for women in those days. So Fake Isle is shorter. She's got her head down. She's much more submissive. Avril has that confident stare right from adolescence. And part of it, I think, is due to the fact that if you've got no female role models for the career that she chose, being a pretty good actress is probably quite good preparation for what you want to do. So moving on, she gets called and she starts work in this building here in January 1922. And by April, it looks like that. Anybody know their Irish history? Why is the building in ruins? Because the Irish Civil War blew the place up. And they blew up the building on the left-hand side, just a bit further down on the bottom photograph, was the legal archive of Ireland. And they blew up 800 years of Irish legal history. All went floating down the Liffey. So Avril finds herself in the law library in St. Patrick's Hall in Dublin Castle, where she's been presented in 1911. So she's back in the same place, but in a completely different role. So that's the only picture of the law library in 1931. Now, if you talk about the law library, if we go on to the next slide, we have a chamber system over here. In Dublin, has anybody been to the law library in Dublin? It is the most incredible place, because you are cheek by jowl, literally. All these desks are in rows and you work like this with a phone in front of you and you are right next to your neighbour. Avril walked in January 1922, the only woman in that melee. But there is an advantage to that melee because there are conventions whereby you can go and consult the senior members of the bar and they are obliged to help you. So it's a very different system from over here. That was a picture taken in 2011, but... Right, so we come on to the next slide. And by 1924, everything's looking fairly rosy. Because also in the archive, we found that in 1924, again something that's not very well known over here, the English bar invited the American and Canadian bars over for a jolly. And those who came over were offered a side trip. They could either go to Paris or they could go to Dublin. And I think those with Irish roots were the ones who chose to go to Dublin. I haven't got the slide here, but there is a slide of a huge table plan. And on the top table are all the new Irish Free State judges, recently appointed, 1924. And then these rows of tables. And they're all full of men, apart from one table that has the women with safe men interspersing them, and it has Avril Deverell, Fay Kyle, it has the first solicitor in Ireland, and it has Molly Dillon Leach, who is the woman who follows Avril into the bar the following year. Except that on one of the tables, somebody didn't realise that they thought the American name Pearl was a male name. So there's one solitary woman on one of the other tables. But there are American women judges sitting on these tables. So it must have looked, you know, pretty rosy. We move on. So in 1927, everything's looking fine. Avril was an avid golfer, as a lot of the women were in those days. And in 1927, she's appointed lady captain of Greystone's Golf Club. another very good place to make your connections with the various people who are going to assist you. She's also a member of the Bar Golf Society. And that's where there's a very interesting story, because in 1927, the Bar Golf Society had gender-neutral membership rules. One Joseph Healy, who actually is the son of Tim Healy, who defended the suffragettes in London, Joseph was a rather different kettle of fish, and on the back of a perfectly innocuous motion to address a lacuna in the membership rules, he slots in a proposal to make them male only and gets away with it. Motion passed after some discussion unanimously. Some of the Canutes who were present when the bill was floating past Ireland were also part of that cadre who introduced those rules. And those rules were not amended back to gender neutral until 1975, 4 years before Avril died. She carried on playing for the Bar Golf Society. I don't know how she managed to do it, but anyway. The next slide. Now, this is going to make me sound like one of those BBC radio programmes about make the connections, you know, that, those cerebral quizzes that they do. If you look at the things that are in the collection and the things that are in the scrapbook, people as diverse as Ellen Terry, Lawrence Houseman, Edith Craig and Queen Caroline are all connected. And in Avril's collection, she has the trial transcript for Queen Caroline. Lawrence Houseman wrote a suffrage poem, which is written in Avril's autograph book by a friend. But he also wrote a book called Pains and Penalties, presenting Queen Caroline as a proto-suffragette. Anybody know about the 1820 trial of Queen Caroline? You know your English history. She was put on trial for adultery because the king wanted to divorce her. And there was a huge scandal. Basically, Joseph Comyn's car is actually a relative of Avril's. And he and Ellen Terry and Edith Craig and Cecily Hamilton are all involved with the Actresses Franchise League. There is also Mary Deverell, who's an actress, who's a member of the Actresses Franchise League. Try as I might, I cannot find the family connection. But Avril goes to see her in a play in London. So, if we then move on, because there's a whole story behind that slide. I mean, it's just an incredible story. But without Avril, without finding out about Avril and without knowing her history and finding her scrapbook and finding her story, we wouldn't know about Naomi Constance Wallace. Because Avril's father, who married Ada Kate Statter Carr, who was the only daughter of a very wealthy London solicitor, who I suspect probably knew George Wallace, the barrister, the London barrister. George Wallace had earlier married William's sister, Nicolina. Okay? And their eldest daughter, and they had four daughters, I think they were probably trying for a son, but... Anyway, they had four daughters. Their eldest daughter was Naomi Constance Wallace, who's one of the first 10 women called in 1922. Okay, so, and here, here in 1909, there's a wedding. And the wedding is the one of the Wallace daughters, the only Wallace daughter to get married. She marries a Treasury solicitor. And Avril very carefully preserves the bouquet that she carried as a bridesmaid with Naomi Constance Wallace. But she also preserves this signed programme from an at-home at Middle Temple. And my guess is that George took his daughter and the 16-year-old Avril to Middle Temple to this event. And Avril must have been quite interested, not just in Middle Temple, which is where, after all, her cousin was going to be called later on, but also because of Middle Temple's associations with Shakespeare and theatre. She would have almost certainly have known something about that. And that must have meant quite a good deal to her. Because she's an avid theatre goer and she's an avid Shakespeare fan. It's obvious from her scrapbook. So it's not just her father, who was Clerk of the Crown and Peace in County Wicklow, solicitor. It's not just her brother. It's not just all the men around her in Ireland who are lawyers, and there are several other family lawyers. It's also this idea that she gets actually taken to a place that has real meaning for her by her uncle. Okay, if we move on. So, the English bar, 1922 to 1927, there was a history of the Irish male barristers coming over to England. It was a required part of their training to come to the English bar. And actually, some of the women follow in the sense that, obviously, Naomi is born here, so she's called to Middle Temple in November 1922. But she's also at Girton with her sisters. She certainly knows Sybil Campbell. She certainly knows a number of the other women who were at Girton. She was Deputy Commissioner of the National Savings Committee, and she was a member of, with her sister, Valerie, of the British Federation of University Women. And she was heavily involved in the setting up of Crosby Hall, which Ros mentioned. So she certainly knew Sybil Campbell. One of Avril's friends, Ida May Coffin Duncan, who is also Anglo-Irish, she was called the following year in Middle Temple. She was a Trinity graduate. She was Dublin University Graduate Women's Association. She also acted with Avril on stage in Dublin as part of the Dublin University Dramatic Society. She was the first to appear in the Court of Criminal Appeal. She, like so many of the other women, opted for a job rather than to stay at the bar, and she became a lunacy commissioner in 1931. I can't find very much other trace of her other than the rather touching story of her rescuing a butterfly from her chair in a county court somewhere in Somerset. No reference to her advocacy skills in court, merely the fact that she was nice enough to rescue a butterfly. That's a photograph of her from Avril's scrapbook. Kathleen Anna Burgess, who was a family friend and who was engaged to be married to Avril's twin brother, is called to Middle Temple in 1927. She is very active in Dagua and in the Irish Federation of University Women, and she goes to the Amsterdam Conference of the International Federation of University Women in 1926. So there's a thread between all of these women. And somebody should do a doctorate or a book on these university women, because they were post-war, they were extremely active, they all knew each other, they were all going to these international conferences, they were in pursuit of peacetime activities, the pursuit of peace and the pursuit of women's education. The archive is in Amsterdam. If anybody wants to follow me to France, then to Amsterdam, they're more than welcome. Then the last person is interesting, Venetia Josephine Mary Stevenson, who's called to Gray's Inn in 1924, is then called to Dublin in 1949 because her mother has Irish property. Can't find very much about her, and sadly, she never gets a seat in chambers in London. She goes from one chambers to another, to another, to another. So actually, being at the bar in Ireland must have been a bit of a relief. She didn't have to get a seat in chambers. She just joined this throng in the law library. Okay, so if we then come to the next slide. The anticipated flood of women at the Irish bar. It wasn't exactly a flood. The next woman, Molly Dillon Leach, her daughter Sylvia is still alive. She was called in 1954. Frances Moran, again involved with DUGWA, was president of the International Federation of University Women, very active. First Irish silk in 1949 and first professor in Trinity. She actually was largely an academic. She never really practiced. Marion Elizabeth Duggan, somebody should write about her. She is the first official law reporter. And she gets the position in 1925 and was asked to step down. She's actually been a very active suffragist. She reported on suffragette cases in the Irish courts, and she's actively involved with a number of leading Irish suffragettes and suffragists. She also becomes a Doyle Court official. That's the alternative courts that were set up during the Civil War. And we think that she may even have been a judge in the Doyle Courts, which would have made her the first Irish woman judge. Not an awful lot known about her, but very possibly asked to step down because of her suffrage associations. She wasn't short of expressing her opinions. Fairly forthright. Kathleen Agnes Phelan, possibly a member of Cumnor Barn, the Irish nationalist movement. Again, a member of DUGWA. She became a civil servant and was then sent by the Irish Free State as a delegate to the League of Nations on the legal changes. 19 Caulfield, 1930, Irish Free State Peace Commissioner. Siobhan McCurtain, her father was an IRA commandant, shot dead in front of his young family before she was called to the bar. Practiced on the Cork circuit, but I can't find any further details about her. Agnes Beatrice Cassidy, a great friend of Avril's, became a professor in 1937, a district judge and chair of the adoption board. Mella Carroll, first High Court judge in 1980. So the Irish do actually quite well on judicial appointments. They do better than the English do. But there's still only this trickle of women who come in. But can you imagine being an Anglo-Irish Protestant woman with a virulently unionist father in the atmosphere of that law library, and those are the women who followed you? Half of them with very strong nationalist connections, some of them Catholic, some of them with very specific views. It must have been interesting in the women's robing room, which incidentally she campaigned to get back after the law library moved back to the forecourts, the restored forecourts. They'd forgotten the women, forgotten to give them a robing room. So she went in hot pursuit of one, got it back, and bless them, they'd put the label Lady Barristers on the door. So she made them take it off and put women barristers on it, which gives you a bit of a flavour. So if there was only that trickle, we've really got a very similar history to the one in England. And for similar sorts of reasons, I suspect, the same level of attrition even when the bigger numbers come in. And most of these women didn't marry. It's a bit of another theme underneath all of that. So if you move on to the final slide, that is my favourite picture of Avril. Again, that direct, confident stare, which I think must have stood her in good stead. I think she probably had quite a strong personality. I don't suppose she made herself fantastically popular on occasions, but she was fairly clever about what she did. She didn't shout, she didn't campaign violently. I think she very firmly knew what she wanted, and she went about getting it. She carried on a practice until 1968, and the last sighting of her, she carried on driving into the forecourts well into the late 60s, had a reserved place in the robing room, a reserved seat for her. She also had an acknowledged parking space. Not a formally appointed one, but an acknowledged one. A hapless junior, foolish enough to park in her space one day, came out and found not one, but all four tyres let down. Culprit unknown. She is known to have had a row with Joe Healy, the one who got the Bar Golf Society rules changed, and apparently got chucked out of his car. And had the last sighting of her, I found in a complaint recorded in the Bar Council minutes, which said that in 1968, so she's well into her 70s, the habit of Miss Deverell and Miss Esther Hogan, a very recently called member of the, very young member of the bar, apparently very glamorous, prone to, good heavens, in 1960s Ireland, wearing a miniskirt under her bar robes. The habit of Miss Deverell and Miss Hogan of walking through the seniors' robing room must cease immediately. And with that thought, I leave you with Avril Deverell, who has more to give us, I suspect.